Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And, folks, if they don't have the authority, they can't do it. It's all about compliance. They don't have the ability to just say, hey, let's do this. This is a good idea. Do we all agree? Then let's do it. They can't do that. They just can't do it. And they've been getting away with it. They've been killing us. They've been stealing our wealth. They've been taking our lives. And they're selling us downriver. All of this is just unacceptable. And the only way out is when we the people, decide to say, you can't do this to us anymore. And folks, you better start seeing that, you know, that shadow that's looming, you know, over the, you know, the horizon that's coming this way. Those are very dark days if we don't stop that from getting here. Welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir.
So we just kind of wrapped up, or I should say you just kind of wrapped up, with the states and slavery and that concept of self-determination. That was so sacred that they knew that they could not have any inkling, any power vested in the federal government at all to be able to meddle within the justice system, within the state's churches, religion, their education, their government, and their functioning. The only thing, they just had to be Republican in form. Most people think that Republican in form is a certain way. Now, I would love it. I'd love somebody to come along and say, the Republican in form means that every state needs to be configured just like the United States government. Which that would play into our benefit, folks. Why? Because that means that your state's counties would have direct representation in the Senate, because your counties would be the parties or the sub-element of the government that is formed for the general purposes of those smaller governments, i.e. the states to the federal. And that every county would have a minimum of one representative in the House legislature. That was the construct of the federal government's representation. Which means if we're to be Republican in form like that, then that's how it should be applied, and that's the way it should have been applied to the states. That's where we need to get. Because when we have that, then we actually start, you know, making sense of, well, amendments, because we're even going to get into the amendments. But amendments, when you want to submit an amendment to the Constitution, well, it just doesn't fly by a mob rule anymore, like all states are doing right now. Folks, we have the way to take back, protect ourselves, and move forward with secured liberties for centuries, if not a thousand years. Because if we get it right and we do what they couldn't do, see, Sean, let me ask you this. You realize that they couldn't even come close to meddling at all and saying, this is what we need to do. They couldn't do that. This is how you need to configure your states because, you know, you guys are all screwed up. They couldn't say that. And they had no track record of how this government was even going to fly. But we have 200 some years now, and we can actually see the profound benefits of having a bicameral legislative body just like our U.S. Congress, if they're being kept within the limited powers delegated, we wouldn't be having any of these problems.
Agreed.
And if we did that to the states, it would get the states right, and our federal government, we'd all be right with God, is I guess the best way to say it. Because that way we have these protections. The distribution of power between the Senate and the House is very unique. So why would we not want to emulate that? And as we look forward, folks, that's exactly how these constitutions, the template for a constitution, a state constitution, coming up with it, and we're going to do the same thing for the county. If the county reaches a certain population to where all of a sudden you have that many people that you need to have, you know, over, I would say probably over 30 representatives, then you need to then split your county into a its own republic to where you have these different districts, and the districts are kind of broken down into representatives, and some districts will have more representatives, and each district will have a senator, and you'll have a bicameral legislature in your county, just like you would in your state. When government grows to that point, then you need to have that so you have checks and balances and makes it easier. It may cost you a little bit more money, but let's look at it this way. Your state government should, these guys should not be making the money that they're making and spending the money that they're spending, just like the federal government. The taxes that we're paying them, why? Because they're in our local knickers. They're telling us what we have to do. They're paying for our highways and our roads and so forth as they skim off the top. Now, as near as I can tell, if you're going to be getting your own, you know, roadways done, then you know if it's getting skimmed or not, and you know what that cost would be. You have no idea how much they're spending out of D.C. to line pockets with gold to come in and set up your infrastructure, what have you, bridges, what have you. So the whole point is that even though you may be paying a little bit more on representation side, the overall cost of government goes down dramatically, especially when we look and we expose you to a constitutional compliance county where the citizens have a responsibility of being the committees. In other words, you may not be a directly representative of legislative power, but you may be elected to be on the infrastructure committee instead of actually having some bureaucrat or some employee for, you know, Tom's Highways sitting on the infrastructure committee. It'll be elected by the people of the different districts so that there'll be representation on these committees to determine whether we need to have potholes fixed or whether we need new roads or whether we do them right the first time. We've even talked about that, right? How our road system is in shambles because we never do it right the first time.
Correct. Because it's just a profit center for the companies.
Yes, absolutely. Because they know after the next winter, they'll be back. There'll be potholes because based on how they do it, it's just abysmal of how poorly we manage ourselves. And we allow this to even happen. And we're the ones that pay for it. Everybody's bilking us from the local government, the state government, and the federal government. And this really goes down to Aristotle's politics, because Aristotle pointed out in his book Politics that, you know, the people, when they wake up and realize that government is getting fat and rich off of their hard sweat and toil, their labor, then that's when the people usually revolt. And yet, because they've removed themselves from, you know, the overall, we don't see really what they're doing. There's no more transparency, and because they've removed the decisions farther and farther away from us, they get away with it. We've got to bring all that stuff back, all of it, infrastructure, agriculture, food, health, all of those types of things. And we can do a much better job than what they've been inflicting upon us, I'm telling you, folks. So anyway, let's dive into this next point that we're going to talk about, which is amendments. This is where Dr. Jarvis talks about amendments. So let's go ahead and dive into this.
Go ahead. There is, sir, another view which I have long since taken of the subject, which has produced a foolish conviction in my own mind in favor of our receiving the government which we have now in contemplation. Should it be rejected, I beg gentlemen would observe that a concurrence of all the states must be had before a new convention can be called to form another constitution. But the present article provides upon 9 states concurring in any alteration or amendment to be proposed either by Congress or any future convention, that this alteration shall be a part of the Constitution, equally powerful and obligatory with any other part. If it be alleged that this union is likely, not likely to happen, will it be more likely that a union of a greater number of concurring sentiments may be had, as must be in case we reject the Constitution in hopes of a better? But that this is practicable, we may safely appeal to the history of this country as a proof. In the last 20 years, we have united against the British, we have united in calling the late Federal Convention, and we may certainly unite again in such alterations as in reason shall appear to be important for the peace and the happiness of America. In the Constitution of the State, the article providing for alterations is limited in its operation to a given time. But in the present Constitution, the article is perfectly at large, unconfined to any period, and may admit of measures being taken in any moment after it is adopted. In this point, it has undoubtedly the advantage. I should not sit down, sir, without repeating that as it is clearly more difficult for 12 states to agree to another convention than for 9 to unite in favor of amendments, so it is certainly better to receive the present Constitution in the hope of its being amended than it would be to reject it altogether, with perhaps the vain expectation of obtaining another more agreeable than the present. I see no fallacy in the argument, Mr. President, but if there is, permit me to call upon any gentleman to point it out in order that it may be corrected, for at present it seems to me of such force as to give me entire satisfaction.
Go ahead with religion now. Go ahead.
In the conversation on Thursday on the sixth article, which provides that, quote, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office, end quote, etc., several gentlemen urged that it was a departure from the principles of our forefathers who came here for the preservation of their religion, and that it would admit deists, atheists, etc., into the general government, and people being apt to imitate the examples of the court. These principles would be disseminated, and, of course, a corruption of morals ensue. Gentlemen on the other side applauded the liberality of the clause and represented in striking colors the impropriety and almost impiety of the requisition of a test, as practiced in Great Britain and elsewhere. In this conversation, the following is the substance of the observations of the... We have an omission there.
I see that. And so, I'm sorry. Maybe it's something that got deleted or what have you. But let me deal with this. You have one of two ways to go. If you have religious tests, then America would lead to religious wars, because you had different states with different religions. And either there would be a forcing and unification of a single religion, or there would be this constant conflict. And the fact that the point of this national, or I should say this general government, not allowing religious tests for it, because the argument was, what Bible would we use? That doesn't have anything to do with your state government. The states have religious tests, and they can maintain the religious tests. You just can't use a religious test for a federal seat. Therefore, it is incumbent upon the people not to allow it. You know, I have a hard time understanding how the best and the brightest, or even the worst, could even sneak in and get into these top seats, at least at that point in time. It wasn't until they started actually creating... So the fact that they went down this path of establishing a religion actually goes down how a religious war ensued when the federal government established a religion. This is why they weren't to do that, and they weren't to have religious tests. You couldn't say one way, you can't teach this, or you can't teach that, or you can't be involved in that. There should be no law respecting religion, period. And yet they decided, and they got away with, establishing a religion called godless secularism. And that thou shalt not bring any forth a god greater than their godless secularism. And that you shall not teach that in the schools. You will not teach your creation ideologies, that we will inflict upon you our ideology of evolution. I'm trying to get my thoughts straight here. So because I wasn't prepared for this, but the point is this, is that's exactly what happened. When they do establish a test, when they do establish a religion, we were okay until everybody started throwing caution to the wind and abandoning this important symbiotic relationship between religion and the state. And that important symbiotic relationship was that the religions always took care of the compassionate services in America. That's all they did. For the most part, there were some places where they went beyond that, you know, in like Massachusetts being one of them right here. But the point is that when they abandoned and told the churches to get out of the schools, that, we're going to go non-denomination, we're not going to pay you for that. It opened the door for the churches to say, well, we can't afford to do this anymore. There needed to be a system, because everybody agrees that we have to have a good education system. And unfortunately, we were led by the nose down the wrong path. Right, wrong, or indifferent, I believe we're at a point in America today where we could really revamp our complete education system and spend a fraction, a minute fraction of what we're spending on education and have probably the world's best education system, period.
The less money we spend, the better it would be.
There you go. Almost. But I mean,
well, under the system that we have now is what I'm talking about. Because it's so top heavy with bureaucrats.
Well, and it's labor. It's
have no bearing whatsoever on the achievement of the children.
And it's labor heavy, period. We don't need, you know, as many teachers as we have. Especially in the age of electronics, where, you know, the same class can be basically used, you know, for teaching math, for teaching science or what have you. Why actually have to have a teacher in the classroom when you can actually have an awesome, and then you can review, and what do you call that? When you challenge a course to go, you know, can we make this better? And so... What's that? Audit. Yeah, there's another word for it, but that's okay. The same. Where you really start actually improving upon the class to actually make them more academically better and less personalized. Less, you know, my feelings of this, my feelings of that. And by going down, I've said this before, by actually having these classes available so that your kids don't even have to go to school, that they just have to, you know, take these courses and be able to test through and understand what they're learning. And if you have a good system that actually teaches them and you have a good family unit, this right here is the huge indictment of our society. We've destroyed the family because that's exactly what the government did. They went after with social engineering, they went after our families. So until we actually get honest and put everything on the table and say, look, we have all of these problems because government's done all these things. And you want to have kids? I don't care. It doesn't matter what your demographics are. You want to have kids? You have to be responsible for your kids' education. It's not our job. But we're here to make sure that if when you get your kids, when you have them, we will have an awesome ability to teaching them. But it's your responsibility to make sure that they sit down and learn and become productive in society. If you're not teaching them that, then... We're allowing you to become a cancer, a parasite within our society to actually cause us harm. This goes back to enlightenment. This is where we start self-disciplining, where everybody has to understand. And maybe we go to, you know, these standards and so forth, but I'd like to see the religions get back involved in this. And as a matter of fact, this is how the godless secular religion basically duped us. Because you don't have to go to church to be godless secular. And that means that you're not spending any tithes. You're not contributing anything. You're just take, take, take. And so when we look at the contributions of the people that are godless and secular, there's zero, zilch. They don't have a budget. So if the state would have actually maintained a relationship with churches and their patronage, and based on patronage contributions and so forth, maybe the state would match some of those to help, you know, augment those churches and those communities in the education process and so forth. Well, those communities that want to be godless and secular, they're not getting anything because they're not raising anything. They're not uniting on anything. They're uniting on themselves. They're uniting on getting drunk or whatever they want to use their money on and get their riches for. We've been used by these godless, secular folks that are, you know, they use the less educated, they use the downtrodden as tools so that they can maintain their caste, their level of affluence and control over us, even though they're godless and so forth. So bottom line is I just see that, you know, until we put everything on the table and literally examine state by state, community by county by county, where are you and what do we need to do to make the best education system for what we've got? We don't need more teachers. We need less teachers. We probably need less buildings and schools and taxes. One thing, and I would say this, I believe that there needs to be a real support on infrastructure. A real support means that if we have a quality ability, every person at every home has a quality ability of having connectivity, access to a road to get to town, to buy food, to get to work, and same thing with access online to be able to get information and so forth. Then I believe that the barriers of having an awesome education system have just, most all of them have gone away. Because you don't need to go to a school when I think everybody can learn. And you know, one of the best motivators I know, one of the best motivators is if you live in an impoverished home, there's a great motivation to basically get out of that situation and to be able to lift yourself up into a better situation, a better life. And so as long as we have this infrastructure and the capability of doing that and the love in the home, then those types of things actually, you know, that right there makes a huge difference in the direction of America and our future. And we've got to look at what all these problems are. And I'm not the king. I think that this is the discussion that we have to have. Everybody has to have this. And as a matter of fact, congratulations, you get to make your own mistakes. You get to listen to yourself and in a vacuum or with as many people in a sounding room, whatever. And whoever prevails, then you follow that. But guess what? You can change your course because you're in control. Self-determination. And I will guarantee you, as we leave the gate and every county starts doing their own thing, more and more counties will start looking at the winning combinations of other counties and so forth and what the best direction would be. And we would, the innovation is, the sky's the limit. I mean, I'm just saying, we would become the world's leader in education, period. I don't even think you'd need a college anymore if we really, you know, started creating, I would just say, open academia and so forth, because colleges are all about money too, right?
Absolutely.
And so where is the real learning? Where is the real learning when it comes to science and biotech? The same thing with engineering. I mean, these corporations that are doing it, yeah, the academic centers teach people the basics, but now you get into the advanced applications, not at school. I mean, you may have some schools and research and development, but most all research and development is done by whom? The corporations. So this creates another symbiotic relationship with corporations, the communities, the churches, and so forth, where we actually start working together instead of you know, allowing bureaucrats to protect their little fiefdoms and so forth and so on. So anyway, I digress. And I dare not, you know, say anything that I, you know, will regret. So I'll stop myself there. We're going to go into break, and then we'll get back with Reverend Shute. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I don't mean to drag the dead horse through all the mud and muck and mire, but anyway, we ready to go on?
Yes, sir, except I'd like to make this note.
Sure.
That has to be the most gracious use of the word folks that I've ever encountered. Just wanted to let you know that.
Who, me?
Yeah.
Okay.
When you were looking for a term for the people who are our oppressors, you said these folks.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually...
That was pretty gracious.
Well, let me just say this.
A few other words.
Well, actually, let me say this. The word folk with the S is improper. Folk without the S is the plural of people. And so it's one of my, I hate that word, and I use it because it's just so so I don't like using it. When I hear people use it, I go, oh, and I even cringe when I say it because.
Listen up, folks.
Yep, folks. Yeah, what's up, Doc?
That was Obama's favorite word.
Yep. All right, so let's move on with Reverend Shute. Thank you so much.
Mr. President, to object to the latter part of the paragraph under consideration, which excludes the religious test, is, I am sensible, very popular for most of men. Somehow are rigidly tenacious of their own sentiments in religion and disposed to impose them upon others as the standard of truth. If in my sentiments upon the point in view, I should differ from some in this honorable body, I only wish from them the exercise of that candor with which truly religion is adapted to inspire the honest and well-disposed mind. To establish a religious test as a qualification for offices in the proposed federal constitution, it appears to me, sir, would be attended with injurious consequences to some individuals and with no advantage to the whole. By the injurious consequences to individuals, I mean that some who in every other respect are qualified to fill some important posts in government will be excluded by their not being able to stand the religious test, which I take to be a privation of part of their civil rights. Nor is there to me any conceivable advantage, sir, that would result to the whole from such a test. Unprincipled and dishonest men would not hesitate to subscribe to anything that may open the way for their advancement and put them into a situation the better to execute their base and iniquitous designs. Honest men alone, therefore, however well qualified to serve the public, would be excluded by it, and their country be deprived of the benefit of their abilities. In this great and extensive empire, there is and will be a great variety of sentiments and religion among its inhabitants. Upon the plan of a religious test, the question, I think, must be, who shall be excluded from national trusts? Whatever answer bigotry may suggest, the dictates of candor and equity, I conceive, will be none. Far from limiting my charity and confidence to men of my own denomination in religion, I suppose and I believe, sir, that there are worthy characters among men of every denomination, among the Quaker, the Baptist, the Church of England, the Papists, and even among those who have no other guide in the way to virtue in heaven than the dictates of natural religion. I must therefore think, sir, that the proposed plan of government in this particular is wisely constructed, that as all have an equal claim to the blessings of the government under which they live and which they support, so none should be excluded from them for being of any particular denomination in religion. The presumption is that the eyes of the people will be upon the faithful in the land, and from a regard to their own safety, they will choose for their rulers men of known abilities, of known probity, of good moral characters. The Apostle Peter tells us that God is no respecter of persons, but in every nation, he that feareth him and worketh righteousness is acceptable to him. And I know of no reason why men of such a character in a community of whatever denomination and religion, ceteris paribus, with other suitable qualifications, should not be acceptable to the people, and why they may not be employed by them with safety and advantage in the important offices of government. The exclusion of a religious test in the proposed constitution, therefore, clearly appears to me, sir, to be in favor of its adoption.
Okay. Comments?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And the fact, it goes back to the fact for me that they only have delegated authority. They don't have authority over personal rights as they've described it earlier.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So why would that even be a consideration? Because they're not making decisions on issues that have to do with that specific denomination or that are encompassed within that, the realm of religion. So what difference would it make?
So I see that I think the two diametrically opposed religions that caused this to basically get injected into the Constitution was the Anglican faith, because it was the Church of England, a political faith, and the Puritan faith. The Puritan faith was pretty intolerant towards anybody else. I mean, they created two states from people deviating from their doctrines. So I think that they saw that if they would have not put that in there, then they would start implementing religious tests. Now, here's the thing. When they create the standard for a person of office in Article 1, Section 2 for the House of Representatives, I think Section 4 for the Senate, why didn't they just put it there? Well, technically, what they did was they put the only qualifications required. They wanted to add in Article 6 that there shall be none for any, including judges and everybody else. Because governments is going to employ more than just representatives, senators, and presidents, and even judges. They're going to employ military men. They're going to employ accountants and all sorts of people. And one of the things that they did right out the gate was they ensured that every person that was receiving a dollar from tax dollars, a dollar from the government, under the federal government, out of the federal treasury, you were receiving money, you were to take an oath to support the Constitution, not a religious test. So I see that that was kind of out of, they didn't get into, or we didn't probably dive into the religious test in the notes on the convention, and it may have been more of a subcommittee thing where it wasn't, what Madison gave us was all of the discussions at the body of the whole. They never went into, they may have reported from the subcommittees, but he didn't take note of any of subcommittee activities that he was involved in. So that being said, I think that as we kind of look at how they just kind of injected, and however they debated it, they let it alone because, again, you want to have religious tests, then you have to dictate what the Bible's going to be for this to be applied at the federal level. If not, then people will just, you know, make shenanigans. So you open that door, that just starts literally establishing something, and it becomes absolutely problematic. So anyway, so now Reverend Payson makes a comment regarding religion, a little down the road here. So let's read what he's got.
Okay. The great object of religion being God supreme, and the seat of religion in man being the heart of conscience, i.e., the reason God has given us, employed on our moral action in the most important consequences as related to the tribunal of God. Hence, I infer that God alone is the God of the conscience, and consequently, attempts to erect human tribunals for the consciences of men are impious encroachments upon the prerogatives of God. Upon these principles, had there been a religious test as a qualification for office, it would, in my opinion, have been a great blemish upon the instrument.
Another reverend stepping up and saying that. And still to this day, we have religious leaders saying, we need to, and we want to go back to, we want to create a biblical Bible. Or not, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that. We want to create a biblical constitution.
Yeah, right. That's ridiculous.
So General Heath now makes a note. Let's go ahead.
Mr. President, after a long and painful investigation of the federal constitution by paragraphs, this honorable convention are drawing nigh to the ultimate question, a question as momentous as ever invited the attention of man. We are soon to decide on a system of government digested not for the people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts only, not for the present people of the United States only, but in addition to those, for all those states which may hereafter rise into existence within the jurisdiction of the United States, and for millions of people yet unborn, a system of government, not for a nation of slaves, but for a people as free and virtuous as any on earth, not for a conquered nation subdued to our will, but for a people who have fought, who have bled, and who have conquered, who under the smiles of heaven have established their independence and sovereignty and have taken equal rank among the nations of the earth. In short, sir, it is a system of government for ourselves and for our children, for all that is near and dear to us in life. And on the decision of the question is suspended our political prosperity or infelicity, perhaps our existence as a nation. What can be more solemn? What can be more interesting? Everything depends on our union. I know that some have supposed that, although the union should be broken, particular states may retain their importance, but this cannot be. The strongest nerve state, even the right arm, if separated from the body, must wither. If the great union be broken, our country as a nation perishes. And if our country so perishes, it will be as impossible to save a particular state as to preserve one of the fingers of a mortified hand. By one of the paragraphs of the system, it is declared that the ratification of the convention of nine states shall be sufficient for the establishment of the constitution between the states, so ratifying the same. But, sir, how happy will it be if not only nine, but even all the states should ratify it? It will be a happy circumstance if only a small majority of this convention should ratify the federal system. But how much more happier if we could be unanimous? It will be a happy circumstance if the majority of the people of this commonwealth should be in favor of the federal system. But how much more so if they should be unanimous? And if there are any means whereby they may be united, every exertion should be made to effect it.
So there you go. So interesting kind of a summation, right? Okay, so now we're going to head down to the president, John Hancock. And this is where he stands up and he recommends amendments and so forth. This is where he intervenes. This is this, you know, moment in time I've been talking about for several days. So let's dive into this.
The president, John Hancock, rose and observed that he was conscious of the impropriety, situated as he was, of his entering into the deliberations of the convention, that unfortunately, through painful indisposition of body, he had been prevented from giving his attendance in his place. But from the information he had received and from the papers, there appeared to him to be a great dissimilarity of sentiments in the convention. To remove the objections of some gentlemen, he felt himself induced, he said, to hazard a proposition for their consideration, which, with the permission of the convention, he would offer in the afternoon.
Okay, so time transpires, the afternoon comes. There you go.
A few hours later.
Yeah.
Afternoon, when the convention met in the afternoon, His Excellency the President observed that a motion had been made and seconded that this convention do assent to and ratify the Constitution which had been under consideration, and that he had, in the former part of the day, intimated his intention of submitting a proposition to the convention. My motive, he says, arises from my earnest desire to this convention, my fellow citizens and the public at large, that this convention may adopt such a form of government as may extend its good influence to every part of the United States and advance the prosperity of the whole world. His situation, His Excellency said, had not permitted him to enter into the debates of this convention. It, however, appeared to him necessary, from what had been advanced in them, to adopt the form of government proposed. But, observing a diversity of sentiment in the gentlemen of the convention, he had frequently had conversation with them on the subject, and from this conversation, he was induced to propose to them whether the introduction of some general amendments would not be attended with the happiest consequences. For that purpose, he should, with the leave of the honorable convention, submit to their consideration a proposition in order to remove the doubts and quiet the apprehensions of gentlemen. And if in any degree the object should be acquired, he should feel himself perfectly satisfied. He should therefore submit them, for he was, he said, unable to go more largely into the subject. If his abilities would permit him, relying on the candor of the convention to bear him witness that his wishes for a good constitution were sincere. His Excellency then read his proposition. This, gentlemen, concluded His Excellency, is the proposition which I had to make, and I have submit to your consideration with the sincere wish that it may have a tendency to promote a spirit of union.
Okay.
The proposition submitted by His Excellency having been committed to a large committee who reported some amendments, we think it expedient to refer the reader to the form of ratification for it.
Now, Samuel Adams, one of the very few times he speaks. Go ahead.
Mr. President, I feel myself happy in contemplating the idea that many benefits will result from Your Excellency's conciliatory proposition to this Commonwealth and to the United States. And I think it ought to precede the motion made by the gentleman from Newburyport and to be at this time considered by the convention. I have said that I have had my doubts of this Constitution. I could not digest every part of it as readily as some gentlemen. But this, sir, is my misfortune, not my fault. Other gentlemen have had their doubts, but in my position, my opinion, the proposition submitted will have a tendency to remove such doubts and to conciliate the minds of the convention and the people without doors. This subject, sir, is of the greatest magnitude and has employed the intention of every rational man in the United States. But the minds of the people are not so well agreed on as all of us could wish. A proposal of this sort, coming from Massachusetts, from her importance, will have its weight. Four or five states have considered and ratified the Constitution as it stands. But we know there is a diversity of opinion even in these states, and one of them is greatly agitated. If this convention should particularize the amendments necessary to be proposed, it appears to me it must have weight in other states where conventions have not yet met. I have observed the sentiments of gentlemen on the subjects as far as Virginia, and I have found that the objections were similar in the newspapers and in some of the conventions. Considering these circumstances, it appears to me that such a measure would have the most salutary effect throughout the Union. It is one of the greatest importance that America should still be united in sentiment. I think I have not heretofore been unmindful of the advantage of such a union. It is essential that the people should be reunited in the federal government to withstand the common enemy and to preserve their valuable rights and liberties. We find in the great state of Pennsylvania, 1/3 of the convention are opposed to it. Should then there be a large minorities in the several states, I should fear the consequences of such a disunion. Sir, there are many parts of it I esteem as highly valuable, particularly the article which empowers Congress to regulate commerce, to form treaties, etc. For want of this power in our national head, our friends are grieved, and our enemies insult us. Our ambassador at the Court of London is considered as a mere cipher instead of the representative of the United States. Therefore, it appears to me that a power to remedy this evil should be given to Congress, and the remedy applied as soon as possible.
Okay, so he goes on and says a little bit more, and folks, I would just, you really need to read the ratification base in their entirety, because a lot of the things that he discusses or that, you know, that they cover just dives into more and more and more and more. We're only giving you highlights. I mean, we're not even coming close to 1/4 of this document of Massachusetts alone. So, I mean, that would be, you know, years of reading 1 hour at a time. So now Dr. Taylor, not Dr. Taylor, down a little bit further. Mr. Bowdoin on Friday the 1st kind of speaks up a republic versus a monarchy.
As if particular state governments are relative to the manners and genius of the inhabitants of each state, so ought the general government to be an assemblage of the principles of all the governments. For without this assemblage of the principles, the general government will not sufficiently apply to the genius of the people confederated, and therefore by its meeting in its operation with a continual opposition due to circumstance, it must necessarily fail in its execution, because agreeably to the idea of Solon, the people would not bear it. It may not therefore be improper to examine whether the federal constitution proposed has a likeness to the different state constitutions, and such alone as to give the spirit and features of the particular governments. For Baron Montesquieu observed that all governments ought to be relative to their particular principles, and that, quote, a confederative government ought to be composed of states of the same nature, especially of the republican kind, end quote. An instance is that, as, quote, the spirit of monarchy is war and enlargement of dominion, peace and moderation are the spirit of a republic, end quote. These two kinds of government cannot naturally subsist in a confederate republic.
Okay. So he keeps on going, and then he now talks about legislative powers of the executive are negatives. So in other words, there are positive and negative legislative powers. Congress has both. They can undo, get rid of laws, void them, remove them. They can create laws. The president cannot create a law. He only has the power to veto or stop a law from going into force. Congress has the ability to overpower that. So you've heard me say this time and time again. The court has no ability to create or even veto law, or it would have been delegated to them in the Constitution. So we kind of highlight this right here. And so this is where he dives into Montesquieu and so forth. And even though this may be redundant, some of the things he kind of comes out of, because he actually speaks a little bit about Montesquieu's view. So let's go ahead and go through this. We got 4 minutes. Go ahead.
The legislative powers of the president are precisely those of the governors of this state and those of New York. Rather negative than positive powers, given with a view to secure the independence of the executive and to preserve a uniformity in the laws which are committed to them to execute. The executive powers of the president are very similar to those of the several states, except in those points which relate more particularly to the Union and respect ambassadors, public ministers, and counselors. Of the genius of the people of the states, as expressed by their different constitutions of government, if the similarity of each in the general spirit of governments concurred to point out the policy of a Confederate government by comparing the federal constitution with those of several states, can we expect one more applicable to the people, to the different states, and to the purposes of the Union than the one proposed, unless it should be contended that a Union was unnecessary? Quote, if a republic is small, says Baron Montesquieu, it is destroyed by a foreign force. If it is large, it is ruined by an internal imperfection. Fato potente sua vi nixe. And if mankind had not contrived a Confederate Republic, says the same author, quote, a constitution that has all the internal advantages of a Republican and the external force of a monarchical government, end quote, they would probably have always lived under the tyranny of a single person. Admitting this principle of Baron Montesquieu's, the several states are either too small to be defended against a foreign enemy or too large for a Republican constitution of government. If we apply the first position to the different states, which recent experience of the late war point out to be true, a Confederate government is necessary. But if we admit the latter position, then the several governments, being in their own nature imperfect, will be necessarily destroyed from their being too extensive for Republican governments. From whence it follows, if the foregoing principles are true, that we ought to adopt a confederation, presuming the different states well calculated for Republican governmental, for if they are not, their corruption will work their destruction separately, and if they are destined for destruction from their natural imperfection, it will certainly be more advantageous to have them destroyed collectively than separately, as in that case we should fall under one great national government.
Okay, so at this point, I don't want to push you to read the next. We'll pick it up from here, but because this gives us a little bit of time, because I want people to understand the convention at the National Convention in Philadelphia, Madison's notes and so forth. They talked about Montesquieu. They talked about they were creating this huge republic, that the republic, a large republic, can defend itself from external threats, but it will be destroyed internally. A small republic cannot defend itself, but it can govern itself really efficiently and well. So you hear me say, and I do this in my writings, I called our republic a hybrid constitutional republic because we have multiple republic layers. We have the national layer, which is strictly a very limited and external. It's a defensive treaty. It's how we deal with all the foreign nations. That's it. No domestic. This is what Madison kind of summarized as well. Then in each state is a republic. And that those republics are a little bit smaller, but still they're big. They can't defend themselves against, you know, large nations or what have you. Collectively they can, but still, you know, some of the states like Texas, California, they might be able to. But some of these other small states, Delaware and so forth, they cannot. So they're kind of an intermediate republic. A small republic is the county. This is why we have these three tiers and why we have three sets of legislatures. But the county we failed to understand and recognize the importance of our county and our county government. Why counties matter most dives into this really well, folks. And I hope that everybody takes time to find that and read that, in addition to all this other reading that we're having you do. Because in understanding our hybrid constitutional republic and why we need three constitutions, the federal general constitution, or basically a general government to support the states, and then at the state government, that supports the counties, and the county government is the end all for the most part. Because now we actually have a three-tiered working system. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.